myrrh, oils, laudanum, spices, perfume, eye paint, giraffes' tails, great lumps of incense, elephants' tusks, greyhounds, monkeys, baboons, and all kinds of precious things. The sailor, filled with gratitude, wants to return with gifts from Egypt, but before he boards the ship, the serpent takes him aside and tells him, "When you have left this place, you will not see this island again. It will have become water." The comparisons with Plato's story of Atlantis that John Gwynne Griffiths draws relate primarily to the rich variety of plant and animal life, including the elephants, said to be found on both islands. Here's Plato on Atlantis. "There were a great number of elephants in the island, for as there was provision for all other sorts of animals, both for those which live in lakes and marshes and rivers, and also for those which live in mountains and on plains, so there was for the animal which is the largest and most voracious of all. Also, whatever fragrant things there now are in the earth, whether roots or herbage, or woods or essences which distill from fruit and flower, grew and thrived in that land. Also the fruit which admits of cultivation, both the dry sort which is given us for nourishment, and any other which we use for food, we call them all by the common name pulse. And the fruits having a hard rind, affording drinks and meats and ointments, all these that sacred island, which then beheld the light of the sun, brought forth fair and wondrous and in infinite abundance. With such blessings, the earth freely furnished them." In addition, there is the fact that Atlantis is a sacred island, and so too, of course, is the island of the Ka, to which the shipwrecked sailor has been brought by a god. The closest resemblance by far, however, is in the fate of Atlantis, which was swallowed up by the sea and vanished, just as the island of the Ka would never be seen again because it had become water. Taking such elements into account, Griffiths concludes that although Plato's story may not derive from Egypt in toto, it nonetheless most certainly owes a conceptual debt to Egypt. His argument is well made. But if he'd been familiar with the Edfu building texts, he might, I think, have stated his case more strongly. Bringing some threads together. We no longer have access to the sacred records once kept at the Temple of Sais in the Delta that Plato tells us contained the story of Atlantis. That temple, which Solon visited around 600 BC, was dedicated to the goddess Neith, and was extremely ancient, dating back at least as far as the First Dynasty, around 3200 BC. Unfortunately, it had been completely destroyed by AD 1400, leaving only rubbish heaps and a few scattered blocks on the site that is today occupied by the village of Sa al-Hagar. At Edfu, on the other hand, although the original sacred records are also gone, the extracts preserved in the building texts do seem to tell essentially the same story that Solon heard and passed on to Plato, and that Griffiths argues also reaches us, albeit in a more fragmented and literary form, in the tale of the shipwrecked sailor. We've already seen that the homeland of the primeval ones in the Edfu texts is described as a sacred island in the midst of a great ocean, so a comparison to the island of the Ka in the tale of the shipwrecked sailor is obvious at the level of the basic geographical setting. The resemblance goes deeper than this, however, since there are many passages in the building texts which make it clear that the first and original god who presided over the homeland of the primeval ones was a dead deity, the Ka. Indeed, we read that the island was also known as the home of the Ka, and that the Ka ruled therein, this Ka who dwelt amongst the reeds of the island. In other words, the homeland of the primeval ones in the Edfu texts is nothing more nor less than the island of the Ka. And to the extent that Griffiths is correct to see a prototype for Plato's Atlantis in the island of the Ka, then the homeland of the primeval ones is also a prototype. What helps to firm up the comparison are certain details given in the building texts that do not appear in the tale of the shipwrecked sailor. Of particular interest is a passage at Edfu in which we read of a circular, water-filled channel surrounding the original sacred domain that lay at the heart of the island of the primeval ones, a ring of water that was intended to fortify and protect that domain. In this, there is, of course, a direct parallel to Atlantis, where the sacred domain on which stood the temple and the palace of the god, whom Plato names as Poseidon, was likewise surrounded by a ring of water, itself placed in the midst of further such concentric rings, separated by rings of land, again with the purpose of fortification and protection. Other details are found in all three stories. For example, the striking parallel between the inundation of the island of Atlantis, as Plato recounts it, and the inundation of the island of the car in the tale of the shipwrecked sailor, is eerily duplicated in the inundation of the homeland of the primeval ones, as described in the Edfu texts, where we read of an upheaval so violent that it destroyed the sacred land. The primeval water submerged the island, and the island became the tomb of the original divine inhabitants. The homeland ended in darkness beneath the primeval waters. Compare this with Plato, who tells us of earthquakes and floods of extraordinary violence, as a result of which, in a single, terrible day and night, the island of Atlantis was swallowed up by the sea and vanished. Intriguingly, Plato also hints at the immediate cause of the earthquakes and floods that destroyed Atlantis. In the Timaeus, as a prelude to his account of the lost civilization and its demise, he reports that the Egyptian priests from whom Solon received the story began by speaking of a celestial cataclysm. "There have been, and will be, many different calamities to destroy mankind, the greatest of them being by fire and water, lesser ones by countless other means. Your own story of how Phaethon, child of the sun, harnessed his father's chariot, but was unable to guide it along his father's course, and so burnt up things on earth and was himself destroyed by a thunderbolt, is a mythical version of the truth, that there is, at long intervals, a variation in the course of the heavenly bodies, and a consequent widespread destruction by fire of things on earth." In the tale of the shipwrecked sailor, too, we find that a celestial cataclysm plays a part. As the reader will recall, the Serpent King speaks of the destruction of his race when a star fell and they went up in flames through it. The same ominous agency turns up in the Edfu building texts, where a serpent is again invoked, but with the significant twist that here it is not the sad and wise ruler of the island, but rather the fatal enemy of the island and its divine inhabitants. To place what the Edfu texts have to say about this in a wider context, let us revisit the Zoroastrian tradition of an evil spirit that sprang like a snake out of the sky down to the earth. He rushed in at noon, and thereby the sky was as shattered and frightened by him as a sheep by a wolf. He came onto the water, which was arranged below the earth, and then the middle of this earth was pierced and entered by him. He rushed out upon the whole creation, and he made the world quite as injured and dark at midday as though it were dark night. To my mind, as I argued in Chapter 7, what we have here is a mythical version of the truth, with the underlying truth being a cataclysmic encounter with a comet. Now let's look at the relevant passages from the Edfu building texts, where a snake called Nipwer, the great leaping one, is described as the chief enemy of the god. It is his assault that causes the homeland of the primeval ones to be swallowed up by the sea, but first the feet of the deity of the island, the Ka, here explicitly described as the earth god, are pierced and the domain was split. This, as Raymond comments, is a clear picture of a disaster. It destroyed the sacred land with the result that its divine inhabitants died. This interpretation accords with other parts of the first Edfu record, which allude to the death of a company, a group of divine beings, and to the darkness that covered the primeval island. Multiple threads seem to come together here. Plato's variation in the course of heavenly bodies, leading to widespread destruction on earth, the murderous falling star in the tale of the shipwrecked sailor, the snake of Zoroastrian tradition that springs out of the sky, pierces the earth and makes the world dark, the great leaping serpent of the Edfu texts whose assault pierces the feet of the earth god, leads to death for the divine company, and cloaks the primeval island in darkness. I'm reminded, too, of the Ojibwa myth reported in Chapter 3, of the star with the long white tail that came down here once thousands of years ago. A star specifically recognized as a comet that caused the first flooding of the Earth. Comet and asteroid impacts not only cause floods, but can also impose huge stresses on the crust of the Earth, resulting in increased earthquake and volcanic activity. How likely, therefore, is it to be an accident that Plato, who was at pains to preface his story with the thunderbolts of Phaethon, implicated both earthquakes and floods in the demise of Atlantis, and carefully dated the whole episode to 9,000 years before the time of Solon, in other words, 9,600 BC? I suggest there's a real possibility that all these traditions are pointing to the same horrific epoch of prehistory. This epoch, as I've argued in earlier chapters, is the Younger Dryas, which began cataclysmically 12,800 years ago and ended equally cataclysmically 11,600 years ago with large-scale floods associated with the cascading collapse of the North American and Northern European ice caps occurring at both dates. The case for multiple impacts from a large fragmented comet initiating the Younger Dryas is, I believe, a very strong one. In the light of the mythological evidence, the possibility must also be considered that it was further encounters with the orbiting debris stream of the same giant comet that brought the Younger Dryas to an end. In the process, I suggest, as so many myths and traditions from all around the world maintain, an advanced civilization was lost to history. Mystery of the Sound Eye. Archaeology is not wrong when it tells us that most of the world in the epoch of 12,800 to 11,600 years ago was populated by hunter-gatherers, locked in the Stone Age, and lacking even the beginnings of agriculture. But Plato, to the eternal frustration of archaeologists, leaves us in no doubt that Atlantis was very different. In brief, it was a great and wonderful empire, commanding a large navy of ocean-going ships that gave it the ability to project its power into Africa as far as Egypt, into Europe as far as Italy, and onto the mainland of what Plato calls the whole opposite continent, by which many believe he meant the Americas, which surrounds what can truly be called the ocean. Atlantis was a fully developed city-state, drawing its wealth from a mature and prosperous agricultural economy, and boasting advanced metallurgy and sophisticated architectural and engineering works, all enhanced by an immense wealth of natural resources. With such blessings, the earth freely furnished them. Meanwhile, they went on constructing their temples and palaces and harbors and docks, and they arranged the whole country in the following manner. First of all, they bridged over the zones of sea, which surrounded the ancient metropolis, making a road to and from the royal palace, which they continued to ornament in successive generations until they made the building a marvel to behold for size and for beauty. And beginning from the sea, they bored a canal of 300 feet in width and 100 feet in depth and 50 stadia in length, which they carried through to the outermost zone, making a passage from the sea up to this, which became a harbor, and leaving an opening sufficient to enable the largest vessels to find ingress. Moreover, they divided at the bridges the zones of land which parted the zones of sea, leaving room for a single trireme to pass out of one zone into another, and they covered over the channels so as to leave a way underneath for the ships, for the banks were raised considerably above the water. Now the largest of the zones into which a passage was cut from the sea was 3 stadia in breadth, and the zone of land which came next of equal breadth. But the next 2 zones, the one of water, the other of land, were 2 stadia, and the one which surrounded the central island was 1 stadium only in width. The island in which the palace was situated had a diameter of 5 stadia, All this, including the zones and the bridge, which was the sixth part of a stadium in width, they surrounded by a stone wall on every side, placing towers and gates on the bridges where the sea passed in. The stone which was used in the work they quarried from underneath the center island, and from underneath the zones on the outer wall as well as the inner side. One kind was white, another black, and a third red, and as they quarried they at the same time hollowed out double docks, having roofs formed out of the native rock. Some of their buildings were simple, but in others they put together different stones, varying the colour to please the eye, and to be a natural source of delight. The entire circuit of the wall, which went round the outermost zone, they covered with a coating of brass, and the circuit of the next wall they coated with tin, and the third, which encompassed the citadel, flashed with the red light of orichalcum. Nobody knows exactly what metal the fabled orichalcum of Atlantis was, since Plato tells us that it survived in his day only in name, but it adds to the aura of technological mastery that still surrounds the fabled lost civilization. Seagoing navigation, advanced agriculture, and large-scale architectural and engineering works are also amongst the notable characteristics of the homeland of the primeval ones described in the Edfu texts. We've already seen how the ring system of canals is prefigured there, but so too are the grand temples of Atlantis. We read, for example, of a chapel measuring 90 by 20 cubits, approximately 45 by 10 meters or 150 by 35 feet. At its front was erected a large forecourt of 90 by 90 cubits, then a hypostyle hall of 50 by 30 cubits was constructed, then another hall of 20 by 30 cubits, and two consecutive halls, each 45 by 20 cubits, were added at the front of the first hypostyle hall. An enclosure is described, measuring 300 cubits, 150 meters or 500 feet from west to east, and 400 cubits from north to south. Within it is a temple, the mansion of the god, and within that a holy of holies measuring 90 cubits from east to west. We also read of a third enclosure on the same grand scale of 300 by 400 cubits. It too contains an inner sanctuary measuring 90 cubits from west to east and 20 cubits from north to south, subdivided into three rooms, each of which was 30 cubits by 20 cubits. But the strongest hint of high technology in the homeland of the primeval ones is given in one of the Edfu extracts that describes the cataclysmic demise of the island, following the assault of the celestial snake called the Great Leaping One, that pierces the earth god and splits the domain. Then we read, and it is most mysterious, that the sound eye fell. The mention of the sound eye appears a little strange, admits Raymond. But she explains, though the texts are obscure on the point, that it seems to be the name of the center of the light which illumined the island. We are, in short, to envisage some artificial system of illumination which lights up the primeval island of the gods. Beyond that, all that can be said with due reserve is that it looks as though there is an allusion to a disaster which caused the fall of the sound eye, with the result that complete darkness fell upon the domain of the Creator. The gods sailed. What happened after the disaster that struck Atlantis? Were there survivors? If there were, what did they do with the advanced knowledge they possessed? Plato's Timaeus and Critias provide no answers to these questions, but the Edfu building texts do, making it clear that there were survivors of the disaster that struck the homeland of the primeval ones, companies of gods who were already at sea when the sacred island was flooded. They sailed back to the former location of the island after the cataclysm, but saw only reeds on the surface of the water. There was a great deal of mud there also, a scene reminiscent of Plato's description of the vicinity of Atlantis after the flood. The sea in that area is impassable to navigation, which is hindered by mud just below the surface, the remains of the sunken island. In the case of the homeland of the primeval ones, it seems that enough of the sunken island remained close to the surface for the survivors to attempt to win some of it back from the sea, an endeavor referred to in the Edfu texts as the creation of the Pei